Welcome to Season 3 of Sea Salt and Parm. I'm Michaela from The Millennial Outside, a teller of stories, a lover of food, a wanderer of wild places, and a wearer of many hats. This is me sharing the simple things in life that I find extraordinary. Can I tell you a story? I'm here with my dad, Vince, and today we're doing something a little different. Instead of me telling you about something I find extraordinary, we're going to have a conversation about our experience climbing Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania this past summer. So if you want to start, Dad, and tell us a little bit about yourself. And you're a big mountaineer, obviously. Tell us a little bit about your mountaineering experience before climbing Kilimanjaro with your daughter.
I started climbing when I was about 12 back in Oregon, and I was quickly hooked by the notion of getting high in the mountains and standing on top of big rocks and piles of snow. And then when I moved to Colorado in the 90s, I really took up climbing at a higher level, bagging 14ers right and left, and moved into more technical climbing and incorporated that into my overall mountaineering. And so at a certain point, I'd climbed all of the 14ers in Colorado, and many of them more than once. And then I started doing larger peaks like Rainier and Denali and Aconcagua. And then you came along and suggested that we go and attempt Kilimanjaro, which I thought was going to be a great experience and something I could do with you.
I remember clearly my first time learning about Kilimanjaro was when you took us to an IMAX movie at the Museum of Nature and Science that my mom was probably not that stoked about going and seeing yet another mountaineering movie, but it was about a dad and a daughter climbing Kilimanjaro. And I remember thinking, I must have been maybe 8 or 9 at this point. I remember thinking, that's what I want to do. I want to do that. And I've never had a huge passion for any other sorts of mountaineering. Like, there's not any other big mountains that I really ever wanted to do, but I was sort of like, I think I could do that one. If this little girl could do it with her dad, I might be able to do it with him too. That was my first thought of climbing Kilimanjaro together. I don't know, what was your first thought of climbing Kilimanjaro together?
I suppose the same day. I didn't know that that was as impactful to you as it turned out being. But I always thought that that would be great fun to get to go somewhere, a destination mountain, and do that with my daughter. So that made me feel really great when you shared that story with me and gifted me a guided climb of Kilimanjaro. It was pretty fantastic.
We did Kilimanjaro. Well, the plan was to do Kilimanjaro for my dad's 60th birthday. Of course, the pandemic sort of threw a monkey wrench in that, and so we did it just shy of his 62nd birthday. It took us from that point, watching the IMAX movie when I was 8 or 9, it was definitely a long and circuitous route to get me to the point where I was actually at the point where I would be down to climb a mountain. There were lots of rock climbing routes where gear was left and tears were shed. There were many 14ers I was drug up, a few ski days where you had to carry my skis and I was crying again. Many tears shed, but we got to the point where I felt like this was something that I was ready to do. Was really set on the idea of Kilimanjaro, that I really wanted to be there and show up. Like, I wanted to be as fit as I could possibly be. I knew that the mental game was going to be a huge part of it. Up at 19,000 feet, I knew, you know, it was going to be so hard on the body, but also hard on the mind, just to put one foot in front of the other. And I felt like I was ready. Like, I had trained so hard and I was like, okay, I'm ready for this. And then there was the like one moment of something that we like, I never thought that it could happen. Like, I hadn't mentally prepared myself for the fact that something out of our control might happen. So if you're wondering what we're talking about, we'll dive in a little bit and tell you the story of what actually happened on our climb. Plot twist, surprise ending, we did not end up summiting, and here's why. So the trip sort of started out, like, right from the very beginning to be a little bit of a cluster. Like,
it was one thing after another. seemed like barricades being put in our way to getting getting to Moshi, where we were supposed to jump off for the mountain.
We had huge delays before we even got out of the United States. We flew from Denver through Boston, and the flight delays in Boston were crazy, and we had delays in Amsterdam, ended up having to switch airlines, and so our baggage didn't show up, and so we spent... That was the first really stressful thing that happened after, like, having to switch airlines and...
Yeah, traveling for over 40 hours just to get to Moshi.
Ended up going through the Middle East, which we were not expecting at all, and...
Flying right over Baghdad was pretty interesting.
It was a wild experience. And then we show up and our bags don't show up, and... let's see, we showed up on a Tuesday and we were supposed to start climbing on Thursday morning. So we were hopeful that our bags would show up on the next flight, but they just kept not coming and not coming and not coming. And finally it was like the night before we were supposed to leave, like 10 o'clock. And our guide told us, your bags, they didn't show up on this last flight. Like, they're not going to be here. Like, you don't have gear. And like, you had some gear with you.
A little bit. I would have had a minimal amount of gear for the mountain. It wouldn't have been a great idea for me to take that small amount of gear on the mountain.
I literally didn't have my hiking boots. I was washing the same pair of underwear in the shower over and over again. Like, I had nothing. I had, like, the clothes on my back and my Kindle, and that was about it. So it was 10 o'clock. Like, that was the first kind of hurdle. Like, the guide came and told us that our bags weren't showing up, and I was, like, just literally crying.
I'm pretty sure you went to bed with tears on your face.
I was sobbing. I was like, this was something that we didn't even think about or prepare for, really. Like, not having gear, being in rural Africa, like, there's no REI there. We'd kind of come up with a plan of maybe finding a place that might rent gear the next morning.
Right.
And then there's this knock on the door about, I don't know, 30 minutes later.
It was 1:30 in the morning.
1:30 in the morning. That's right. And our bags showed up. The airline had brought our bags, and there they were. And we went downstairs, and we signed for them. And, like, that was the highest feeling ever. Like, there was nothing that could stop us now that we had fresh underwear and hiking boots.
Right. But we were frantically packing our bags for the mountain at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we had a 7 o'clock wake up to head out towards the mountain. So it still, even though we had our stuff and we were rejoicing, it still was a stressful element of making sure that we were packing the right stuff, leaving the right stuff, that we didn't miss something important. For me, that was still a challenging morning's activity.
Absolutely. Like, everybody else on our trip had days to pack it to the duffel bags that our porters would be carrying and weigh the importance of every little item and decide what to leave and what to take. And we're just kind of like throwing everything in bags. Like, I came home and I found my melatonin is in an allergy medicine bottle. I was looking for my melatonin the other night. I'm like, where is it? And I opened a bottle of allergy medicine. Like, literally, we were just shoving things in everything to try to make things small and fit, and a little bit chaotic for sure.
Yeah, but we did get to the mountain on time, basically, and with our team, and we were able to start off and head up Kilimanjaro finally after all that time.
We took the Rongai route, which was on the Kenyan side, so we had a long drive over to that side of the mountain. We were going to hike up and over the Rongai route and come back down on the Tanzanian side, closer to Moshi. And that first day, we had a couple of slow miles. We were a little bit surprised at the pace. There's this Swahili phrase, pole pole, which means slowly, slowly, and we were hiking very slowly.
Yeah, it was very slowly, especially for me. It was a shock to my system.
Definitely. We camped the first night, and we woke up to some beautiful views of... you could see the mountain in the distance, kind of one of our first views of it. It had peaked out when we were at the hotel, but this was kind of the first more up-close view of it.
Yeah, you got a sense of what we were up to at that point.
And then that second day, we started kind of coming out of the vegetation, and as everything got a little lower, the trees got shorter and kind of gave way to scrubland. You could see more of the mountain and very deserty, kind of volcanic over there.
Yeah. I guess the dryness was one of the things that surprised me about Kilimanjaro. Once we got out of the jungle, it dried up very quickly.
Yeah.
And all of our campsites were positioned due to their availability of water, because water just wasn't readily available in many places on the mountain.
It was about that second day that, like, you were wondering if it was the dryness or the dust that was making your throat scratchy. Like, you started to get a scratchy throat and was thinking it might be allergies.
Yeah, I was taking allergy tabs by the handful, thinking I was allergic to either the dust or the different plants or whatever.
The funny chicken.
The funny chicken, oh. or the food, yeah. The food was very interesting. We had porters and guides, and they were fantastic people. But the Africans eat very differently than we do here in America.
It was just wild having, you know, we're at 11, 12, 13, 14,000 feet, and we've got, they were apparently carrying up raw meat. Like, we were having chicken wings, and they were carrying up, we had glass, like coffee mugs and ceramic plates and regular silverware. It was sort of a glamping experience,
it
honestly.
Was, yeah, it was pretty opulent for a mountainside fare, for sure.
So I feel like it was like about that second night that you kind of solidly decided it wasn't allergies, right?
Yeah, I think the third morning I was definitely convinced, but that second night I said, I may be more to this than allergies. And of course you didn't want to hear that, but I needed to be honest about how I was feeling.
I feel like kind of midday that third day I was starting to get a little bit stuffed up, and you were like, your throat, you kept saying it felt like you're swallowing glass.
Yeah, I've never had a worse sore throat. And I thought maybe I had strep throat or something like that. And but then you started getting sick, and I was watching how it was hitting you differently than me.
I don't think I got really a sore throat at all. It was mostly just like cold-like symptoms that third day. And then the fourth day we woke up probably just under 12,000 feet, right?
Right around there, yeah.
Right around 12,000 feet. And I woke up and I was feeling so nauseous, like so nauseous. And all of the porters and guides thought that I had altitude sickness. Like, they kept telling me I had the mountain sickness. I'm like, I'm at 12,000 feet. I'm always at 12,000 feet. Like, I do not have altitude sickness. There is no way I have altitude sickness. But I was so nauseous. I couldn't eat anything for breakfast, really. I had bad cold-like symptoms. That morning, your throat was still killing you, and you were kind of getting more cold-like symptoms as well.
Yeah. So we had a rough fourth day.
And that was the day that was kind of like some of our biggest elevation gain. Yeah, I think it was only like 2 or 3 miles, but we got up to 14,000 feet. And so that was kind of our highest elevation. Fairly high elevation for us. We hike 14ers frequently, but still it's a big elevation.
Sure. I've never camped at 14,000 feet and not had mild headaches, and definitely noticed the altitude. Whenever you create any exertion, it gets to you really quickly.
Yeah.
But I didn't expect either one of us to have any kind of altitude sickness at 14,000 feet.
By the time we got to that camp, like, it was such a beautiful camp. It was tucked right under Moenzi, which is one of the sub-peaks of Kilimanjaro, which is kind of actually, it's a more dramatic-looking peak than Kibo, which is kind of the main peak. So just super beautiful, like, getting to camp, and it was all tucked up underneath the mountain, and just very dramatic and kind of alpine, deserty.
Well, and there was a tarn there, too.
Yes. It's kind of a gross-looking little tarn. It's like, we're drinking water from this? And I just felt like total crap. Like, it was so lovely. Every time we got to camp, the porters would greet us with these amazing songs and dances, and I was just like, the rest of our group wanted to take photos, and I'm like, please just let me go lay down in my tent. Like, I'm dying. And I skipped lunch and just spent the entire afternoon just trying not to be dead in the tent.
Yeah, I was beginning to get seriously concerned about your condition. But at the same time, I was dealing with the worst sore throat that I ever had, and it wasn't getting better. And my cold symptoms were stronger, and now we're at 14,000 feet. So I was really hoping that the cold medicine that we were taking at that point in time would get on top of it, and all of the exertion that we were doing would allow us to burn that cold out of our system. But it kind of quickly became obvious that that was not what was going to happen. When you started coughing really bad and your cough was productive, and I went out to go on a acclimatization hike, and
I'm in the tent and I'm coughing, and this is there's no way not to say this is gross, like, but I had like an upset stomach earlier that day, so I didn't want to be like swallowing what I'm coughing up, like I'm coughing up loogies, like I didn't want to swallow them, and so like I spit it into a tissue and there's like blood, like I'm literally coughing up blood. And that was the moment I was like, oh, this is not good, like, and I'm like sitting in the tent, I'm like, Dad. He wasn't right there, and one of the guides came in, and I was like, I'm coughing up blood. And then they went and found my dad, and I think that was the moment, like, I was really concerned. Like, that feels scary. Looking back on it, it was very, like, bright red blood. Like, it was probably just from, like, an irritated throat. Like, right. It wasn't.
Well, it was dry and dusty, and we were drinking highly chlorinated water, and and my throat was inflamed to the point where it literally felt like I was swallowing glass. So for you to cough up a little bit of blood was definitely not good at any point in time to do that. But then on top of that, the guide had some tests, and we both took our COVID tests and found out that we were positive for COVID-19 at 14,000 feet in Africa.
So wild. Like, I just remember taking it and being like, okay, we're taking it. Like, this is just a precaution. I didn't at any moment, like, actually think I was going to test positive. Like, I don't know why. Like, we'd spent 2.5 years, like, dodging this really scary, really horrible virus that, you know, took loved ones from us. And I don't know why, it just was not at the top of my mind at that moment. And it was really scary to see like that second line appear on the COVID test. And then yours did as well.
Yeah. Well, I suppose we were both vaccinated and boosted and felt like we should have had some level of immunity against it because we were healthy and fit and ready to go tackle a big mountain, one of the seven summits. For that test to come out positive was really quite shocking.
It was. The second, like, both of our tests came positive, I think it was kind of just, like, into survival mode, like, figuring out how we were going to get off the mountain.
Knew right away, as soon as they told me what was going on, that we would be leaving the mountain. Even though you and I had a bit of a agreement that if one of us couldn't press on summit day or something, that we wanted the other person to go ahead. This was a very different thing for me. I immediately knew that the right thing to do was leave the mountain. And that was before I even tested positive myself. And we didn't want to expose any of our other teammates or guides or porters. So it really just became a completely different focus immediately. And I really put the mountain out of my mind, other than how do we get off of it.
In those moments there, it wasn't like, I wasn't feeling like sad we weren't summiting. It was just kind of like a shock about, you know, like the COVID finally catching up to us and being on the mountain and totally feeling terrible. Like, I'm pretty sure at that point there was some COVID brain fog going on too.
Oh, like, I couldn't find my hat. I couldn't find my gloves. It was ridiculous. I just was stumbling around like an idiot when we started packing our things. I definitely experienced COVID brain. and we even later on when we got back to the hotel, we were so COVID-brained that you put a notepad out so we could write down important things that we needed to remember because we were both just space cases.
It was a wild feeling. Our guides had a sat phone and they called down, or maybe it was the Rangers that had a sat phone. Somebody had a sat phone and called down. We were very lucky actually where we were. We were about 5 miles from like a four-wheel drive road that the Park Service could access with Land Rover.
To evacuate us,
yeah. So it was actually a good spot to have it happen. Like it could have been a lot worse, I feel like. Some of our porters helped us pack up and we bundled up. It was pretty cold at that point. Like that night we encountered even like a few flurries of snow.
Yeah. And then we had a 5.5 mile death march through the night. Because I think we left camp about 8:30 in the evening. And we hiked 5.5 miles, however long that took, to get down to the huts.
Look under the stars. It was actually really beautiful.
It was a beautiful night. And I remember as we approached the hut, we were probably 3/4 or more of the way there. Do you remember the light hitting the horizon? And the largest moon I've ever seen rose right in front of us. So it was quite spectacular. And there's something about the air in Africa and the density and the, you know, smoke and things. The moon was an eerie color and it was larger than any moon I'd ever seen. Amazing. I'm just getting goosebumps remembering it.
We got to one of the farther down camps. There were some huts down there, like a ranger station and some huts. And our ride wasn't there yet. And so we were able to lay down for a little bit and get a little bit of sleep in the huts. And then we're awoken again at, I don't know, maybe like 3 o'clock in the morning.
2 or 3, somewhere in there.
And herded into a Land Rover. And this whole time, it was very interesting, like culturally, that the Tanzanians just really didn't seem to understand COVID. Like, and we would later learn that it was because their prime minister at the beginning of the pandemic basically shut it down, fake news it, and maybe ended up dying. There's some sort of controversy, but like probably died of COVID, but like the vaccination rate was like 7%.
Right. And leadership were COVID deniers. So,
yeah. So there was just like this not even understanding of what COVID was. And then we later learned they didn't even call it COVID. They were still calling it Corona. So I'm not even sure they really understood what was happening when we took the test. Like to the very end, I'm pretty sure they thought I had altitude sickness.
Right. The guy who owned the guide service, even when we were back at the hotel, claimed that you had HAPE. We were both like, no, she has COVID-19. We both do.
So we get like shoved into the back of this Land Rover with these bench seats with all the porters, the guides, some of the rangers, like anybody who needed a ride down the mountain, basically.
And all of our gear.
And all of our gear. So it was a very tight squeeze. And then like the scariest part of our evacuation probably happened.
Oh yeah. It was the most terrifying ride of my life. The road, where the road was rough, they had poured 2 strips of cement about the width of the truck tires, and those strips of cement weren't even 2 feet wide. And this guy was driving like a Formula One race car driver down this mountain.
He had to have been going like 60, 75 miles an hour.
I'm pretty sure I could see the needle every once in a while. I don't think we got over 50 kilometers an hour, but it did seem... it was far too fast.
And like a night, like when you have no idea, we're in the African bush, like what kind of animals are going to jump out or. Yeah.
So I think that he thought he was saving our lives by getting us to a lower elevation as quickly as possible. But it was a terrifying ride.
So we're white knuckling it, like slamming around. It was quite interesting. And then we got to the gate of the mountain and the gate of the national park, and the guiding company owner came and picked us up in his car and brought us back to the hotel we'd been staying at, which luckily still had room for us because we were back several nights early. Like yes. We were supposed to have been on the mountain another 3 days.
Yeah, we really were taken, well taken care of once we got back to the hotel. They worked with us and made sure that we had a room, and you know, they would bring us food for breakfast. And fortunately, there was a nice cabana at the pool, and the hotel was sparsely populated, so we were able to actually enjoy quite a bit of our quarantine, sunning ourselves by the pool and
playing lots of Yahtzee.
Oh, so much Yahtzee.
Which was pretty fun with the COVID brain fog, like the math for the scores. Who knows who actually won any of those games?
And also fortunately, we weren't scheduled to leave the country for about 5 days.
Yeah.
So we did get to stay at the hotel and convalesce in our hotel room and basically slowly get more healthy and regain our cognitive skills.
We're so focused, I feel like, that whole time too, on just like, we're worried about being able to get back, like, you know, testing requirements had just dropped, but we were worried we weren't going to test negative by the time we left, and just worried about, like, you know, how long are we going to be stuck in rural Africa. And so I feel like it wasn't really even until we got home that it kind of like that, like, I let myself stop and think about like what it meant to like have left the mountain without summiting.
Yeah, I talked a little bit about that on the trip home. I was hoping that you didn't have big regrets about leaving the mountain, because it's such a destination, and we had put so much into attempting that mountain. Now, for me, of course, it wasn't anywhere close to the first time I had to come off of a mountain, and I felt like this time was probably the easiest because it was so obvious it was the right thing to do and it just needed to happen. But I really at no point had big regrets about having left the mountain. And like you said, until I got home, hadn't really processed that, you know, that was such a big deal before we left. And we neither one of us really shed a tear for having to leave the mountain.
We shed a tear because we finally made it on the plane home. That was lovely.
That was fantastic.
So Kilimanjaro was by no means the first time. You've already alluded to that, you having to leave a mountain earlier than the summit. Tell me a little bit about kind of the biggest one that sticks out to you.
Well, there's actually a couple, I suppose, and they were for very different reasons, which is why they're probably equal in my memory of the experience and in some cases the trauma of having to leave a mountain before you get to your destination, the summit. The first time I had to leave a mountain was undoubtedly a 14er. I don't even remember. There's been many of them where either the weather didn't cooperate or the time got too late to safely summit and return. So there's a certain point. Well, actually, another big one was when I just barely didn't make the summit of Fuji.
Mm.
And I just didn't have the time available to me when I was there to actually make a full climb. And I was so close, but I had to turn around and make the last bus off the mountain. But then there was a time where I was doing Rainier, an unsupported trip with just buddies, climbing buddies on Rainier. And one of our party, well, we actually had two of our party fell on a glacier and started rocketing down the glacier while we were all roped together. And my best climbing buddy was in front of me climbing this really nasty ice pitch. And I was basically watching him and being a safety man for the rope team. And thank God I was paying attention, because when my teammates behind me fell and started falling down the mountain attached to the same rope that all of us were on, I was able to then self-arrest the whole rope team and keep everybody from getting injured. But that really shocked one of my teammates to the core, and he a short period after that decided that he couldn't go on. He was too freaked out. He wasn't comfortable being on the mountain and going further into the challenge of the mountain. So we ended up making a group decision to descend all together and come down the mountain. Probably the biggest one was when I went to Denali, and I think that was probably in 13. And I, again, it was a self-supported trip. I went with two other climbers who I had also done Aconcagua with, and we were going after Denali, and that's a big, dangerous mountain. And the dynamic on that trip just was never good. It was never right. I was at odds with our quote-unquote lead climber, and almost from the get-go, and it devolved to the point where we found ourselves pinned down for several days at 14,000 feet. Again, this 14,000 foot unlucky number. I made the decision as I was pinned down in my tent for 3 days that I was not achieving what I wanted to achieve on that mountain. I was not going to feel comfortable going further up the mountain with the dynamic that was going on in our team. And we had run low on food and fuel, and it just wasn't the right thing. I just, in my soul, my heart, I knew going on was not the right thing to do. And even though, and that's probably the only tearful example of me leaving a mountain with great regret, I chose to come down the mountain rather than go against my spirit and my intuition and try to fight on and continue on up the mountain.
That was definitely a big one. Like, I remember getting the call from my stepmom, Sally, your wife, and that you were coming down the mountain, and that just being like, that was a big deal. Like, you being a mountaineer our whole lives, like, that was, it felt like Denali was kind of like a pinnacle, if not the pinnacle, of your climbing career.
It was, and it was intended for me to be able to apply all of the mountaineering tools and knowledge and experience and that I had amassed over decades and put it all together into that one big climb. So for me, it was a really big deal to turn around and turn my back on the upper mountain. And on top of that, there was the fact that descending Denali solo is never a good idea. Really climbing or descending Denali solo is never a good idea. It's a very dangerous environment. So I, in fact, at the end of the day, did have to use all of my skills and my knowledge to safely descend the mountain and achieve another goal that I set for myself on the way down the mountain, which is to get down in one day and get back all the way into Talkeetna. I just truly left the mountain in one day. It was actually quite a Herculean feat, but I had that much resolve that it was the right thing to do.
So there's kind of, you know, that's, you talked about three different mountains. There's three very different experiences of leaving. You know, in my last podcast episode, you can go back and listen to it if you haven't listened to it yet, for those listeners out there. But I talked about grief a little bit. Last year was a big kind of grieving year for me personally, for our family. We experienced a lot of loss. Grieving for something physical that's there, whether it's a person or a dog or whatever it might be, something that you've lost, feels different, but in other ways, like, very similar to the idea of grieving the loss of something that maybe never was. Like, the summit never was, but in this, it was a loss in the same way. Over the last year, we've had lost opportunities. Everybody had 2.5 years of loss from COVID, of, you know, all of the things that could have been that weren't. How do you grieve? Like, what has been your process to grieve, like, Denali or Rainier, or have you grieved Kilimanjaro? Like, have you, or does it not feel like grief in the same way or a similar way to you?
Well, as you pointed out, each one of them was under very different circumstances. I suppose Fuji was a disappointment, but it was also kind of almost a gift-wrapped attempt, opportunity to attempt Fuji when I was over there on a business trip. And I climbed so well that day and faster maybe than I ever have. And I got within 600 or 700 vertical feet of the summit before I decided I had to turn around if I was going to make the last bus out of there. And I wasn't prepared to spend a night on the mountain, nor was it even legal for me to spend a night on the mountain. So that one, not so much grief, but just a little disappointment niggling. I suppose the first thing that really I grieved was on Rainier when we were going after Liberty Ridge, which is one of the 50 classic climbs of North America. And I was doing it with, you know, the best climbing buddy I've ever had, a very talented climber, Clinton McKenzie. And the other two guys were ridiculously fit. I was prepared and fit, and we had all of the right gear and all of the right experience. And then when Taylor had his experience and decided to come down the mountain, I was angry for a while. I felt a little bit robbed. So I suppose that one I mourned a little bit. There was some regrets, and we put so much into it and so many training climbs, and all of that just came for naught because Taylor got gripped with fear on the ridge after almost falling, you know, down into a crevasse on a massive glacier.
Honestly, fair. I would have done the same thing.
So, and it was fair. And over time, I've forgiven Taylor and come to grips with how inappropriate my anger was at the time. But I was disappointed. That's how I processed that one. Denali was really hard because there was some interpersonal stuff that went on in the mountain, some really inappropriate behaviors, and that some of that continued after the mountain. So it was really a shock to the system because mountaineering has always been a place of joy for me. I mean, sure, there's terror and there's strife and hardship, but that is what makes it worth doing. Is, you know, it challenges you on so many levels, and you really get to test yourself on the mountain because the mountain is just there. You're throwing yourself at it and to see if you have what it takes to actually stand on top of the mountain or have a successful experience, whatever your experience goal is for that mountain. With Denali, it was not about the mountain. It was about not being there with the right people and then having really negative experience to the point where I literally walked away from a long time mountaineering dream. So that one was tough, and it took me, I still talk about it. It took me a long time to really process that and to mourn the missed opportunity. Now my climbing partners, who I left a bunch of my food and fuel with, did in fact summit like 4 days after I left the mountain. So that was great. We did get part of the team up there, which was our ultimate goal. It was just my personal summit that didn't happen.
What have you felt about Kilimanjaro?
Kilimanjaro was physically really easy for me. I really enjoyed the people we were with. I enjoyed my time on the mountain with you greatly, and not summiting just hasn't really been a slap for me. I know that I could do it, and it's likely I'll go back and attempt it again at some point. The regret I had was that, you know, we didn't make it together, but then we had actually quite a bit of fun in our quarantine. It was tough. It was a tough period, but we made the best of it and we laughed a lot and we just did the things that we could do and kept our spirits up and had a great opportunity to visit, which we don't always get that kind of quality time for, especially for that period of time.
There was a lot of quality time.
There was a lot of quality time. And so for me, it was a different journey than I envisioned, but it was still a fun journey.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of good that came out of it.
I feel like I have had everybody who I've talked to since I've came back is kind of like, oh, like, it sucks so bad you didn't get a summit. Like, how are you feeling about it kind of thing? And I keep waiting for it to hit me, like, being sad about it. But I felt very much the same way. Like, when I look back at it, I just keep having this, like, huge sense of gratitude. A, that we made it back down off of the mountain. Like, obviously, COVID was no joke. Like, even fully vaccinated, we had quite a rough experience with it, and it could have been a whole lot worse. And so I'm just very grateful we both made it down relatively unscathed. But then just also for the experience, like, it was, I had been so focused on the mountain, I didn't really think about, you know, experiencing African culture. We met some of the most amazing, warm, great people. Even just like walking around, we do our little like walkabouts every day, kind of trying to socially distance through some of the neighborhoods. And everybody was just so friendly. Like the guides we met, we got to do like a coffee plantation experience, which is probably honestly where we got COVID before the mountain. And yeah, then just getting to spend time with you, like it was an adventure. My boss, when I came back, said it probably wasn't the story you were after, but you definitely came back with a story. And I liked that. It was, you know, it was an adventure. It was a story. It also makes me think of when you climbed Aconcagua, you climbed it with a team of people you hadn't really climbed a lot with before. And the lead guy was kind of, how would you describe Stephen McGee? A bit, a life coach?
Yes.
Is that what he does?
Yeah.
And so his big tagline for this climb was, find your Aconcagua. And so we had little, that was the days of the jelly bracelets, like the Livestrong bracelets. And so everybody had a bracelet that said Aconcagua on it, like all of the spouses and kids and friends and everybody who was involved in, you know, supporting this team as they did their climb. And it was about, you know, the summit isn't necessarily the point of the climb. Like the point of the climb is whatever the point of the climb is, or even if it's not the climb, like whatever it is, it's like, it's not necessarily about that pinnacle moment. It's about the journey to get there. It's about overcoming specific things. And like you said, I felt very much for the entire climb, like I was ready. Like I definitely feel like I could have done it. And for me, like that personally was a win, because when I started training 6 months or so before we started going, I was like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, I set myself a goal of like 90 minutes on the stair climber, because I'm like, that seems like a big, horrible like goal. Like, if I can hit 90 minutes on the stair climber, I can do anything, because it seemed like totally unreasonable. And then I hit 90 minutes and then I was like, I'm ready.
Yeah, there. I think that we all have those moments with the big mountains in particular. I really did much the same thing you did for Kilimanjaro. I did for both Rainier and Aconcagua. And both of those mountains, I had less time than I probably needed to get in top physical shape, but I was able to get myself ready to the point where I felt good going on the mountain. With Kilimanjaro, I was really a little lackadaisical. I wasn't in top physical shape, but
my sister kept texting me and she was like, you need to get dad out training hiking. He's not doing anything. I'm worried about him. Of course he was fine. We call him an alien, because it doesn't matter how much time he spends on the couch. He's ready to go and he'll kick everybody else's ass.
Well, I was feeling good on Killy and I didn't really have any physical challenges until COVID started kicking my butt. But, yeah, I think that, you're setting a big hairy goal. And that was kind of the point of the Aconcagua Man project, was find your Aconcagua, plan to take it on and go, you know, tackle the Aconcagua in your life. For me, it was literally Aconcagua.
To kind of bring this full circle, like the point of this episode was sort of the simple thing that I find extraordinary about this whole experience is, and it's something that I've recognized in lots of outdoor pursuits, whether it's going on a big backpacking trip or, we did a big ski race a couple of years ago where we had to do something like 26 bump runs like in a day, a big bike ride or anything that's just kind of big and physically challenging, that it's less about like actually getting the thing done and it's more about just like showing up and trying and being the best version of yourself and enjoying the ride, enjoying the journey. So to finish up, like, but what is it about mountaineering that, like, what do you love about it? What is it to you?
Mountaineering to me is a place where I found out how to find my limits and either become comfortable with those limits or push myself through them. And for me, that was the magic of mountaineering, to face fear and overcome fear and walk through it. And in doing so, become stronger and become more aware and become more in tune with myself. So the mountains showed me myself, and what a beautiful place to go and be able to be with yourself and to find yourself.
Yeah, there's no better place. And that's extraordinary. Thank you for being my first podcast guest. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening, friends. If you like Sea Salt and Parm, please subscribe and leave me a rating, which helps the algorithm suggest my podcast to more listeners. You can find me on Instagram @TheMillennialOutside.